This evening, we're going to spend our hour. I try hard to not run over. There are always a myriad of things that are available to you. There's dancing on the bridge and meeting with people and things like that. Tonight, I probably won't run over because I have the distinct impression that I'm running out of steam. I want to spend some time. It was requested last week that we continue on the discussion of the relationship between art and the church, and at least somehow bring things as up to date as is possible. I alluded to the fact last week that we are heir to a lot of sometimes conflicting traditions. The Gothic tradition is ever present. There's very little way of convincing people that it shouldn't continue. And of course, the more you see of it, the more you want it to continue because it's magnificent. There's just no question about it. At the same time, Lutherans in particular, I shouldn't say in particular, the Calvin tradition, are heir to as iconoclastic a tradition in their art and church relationship as you had in the Byzantine Empire. There are those who are suspicious of art in any form, fearing that it does cause idolatry. It also helps them concentrate on that idolatry and ignore the other idolatries. It's strange how really ever-present that kind of tradition is, particularly for me, my experience in the Lutheran Church. The Roman Church is quite free as far as this tradition is concerned, and has been doing some tremendously exciting things. I might also add, Carol, that the Jewish tradition is doing some incredible things also. In contemporary art and architecture as it relates to the building of new synagogues. I would in fact be very interested in discussing with you the non-image tradition, since I've got a whole tray full of really beautiful Jewish images taken out of synagogues and all the way up to the present with Marc Chagall and that kind of thing. It's a tremendously rich heritage. So that there is a lot happening. We just got into with a relatively wild amount of freedom, I thought, the building of forms and styles of architectural design and individual art objects and their construction. When the liturgical renewal hit us, it had already been going on for some time. In Europe. Someone said it could have happened here earlier, except that there weren't enough bombs dropped on our country. When you have to start over, you tend to start really over with whole new traditions. And every now and then when a church wants to be remodeled, you wish that maybe a bomb was available somewhere so you could just scrap the whole thing and begin from scratch. But the liturgical renewal, brought an emphasis into the building of contemporary churches that was extremely important and essential, and got people away from a purely aesthetic reason for building and into the reason why they got together in the first place, and then capped that reason and that format with whatever form was essential. And it's kind of interesting that contemporary church architecture, for a while at least, seemed to be going back to that early Christian thing with nothing on the outside and everything on the inside. It made one wonder whether the Christian church was going underground, and there were some very exciting things happening. Then, of course, the next important phase happened, and this was the social upheaval in our country. The church got caught up, and it was about time. But it became the church's business to be in the job of seeing to the needs of people, seeing to their food, to their clothing, etc., etc. What happened was that more money, and I don't want to get into the money game with you and tell you how much it was spent, you know, in 1960 on church building and how much is being spent now on church building in comparison. It really doesn't matter. But there is a very definite shift away from those buildings which are done purely to house churches who worship. For example, it would seem strange, but there was a church in Tennessee, Chattanooga, 1.75 million. Now, 1,150,000 of that was to be spent on a worship room. The traditional chancel, nave, narthex, windows, choir, organ, etc., etc. We did a time study of this particular program, and that room, which would cost the congregation over $1 million, was to be utilized 94 hours a year. 94 hours a year. The rest of that time, that room was to remain vacant. Obviously, these people were not listening to what was going on around them. They were just simply not aware of the conflicts, of the struggles. They were not looking at the poor. They were not looking at their mission obligations. They were not, in fact, being the church. One does not like to be judgmental, but in certain cases, it's just too tempting not to be. And so you can feel. It was absolutely foolish. I just want to give you examples so that you know what the concerns are in various evidences of them around in the church, and I'm sure that each of you has a few of these on your own. There is a very considerable amount of talk about a moratorium on church building, that you just simply stop it altogether. I don't agree. I just simply think that we've got to redesign them, that church buildings have to do more than they are doing now. There are incredible numbers, particularly in urban areas, of church buildings which are just simply vacant. There are for sale signs in front of churches. I've got a whole tray of them. It's depressing. All kinds. Some of them very new, and they're for sale. The building just simply put a congregation into hock for the, for 35 years. And as I'm sure you must be aware, a particular suburb moved. It wasn't there. All of a sudden, everything was gone, and this church was in the middle of a community that was not the community that built the church. There was nothing to go on in there. So they turned them into libraries. They're very neat for artist studios. If you know of a nice church somewhere in the hills somewhere that no congregation is using, let me know. If I can get it cheap, I'll turn it into a studio. there got to be a few. Okay, so what happens now with a church that has gone through the whole process of understanding or attempting to understand its mission? Because I am convinced that a building, which is a building strictly for a church, is the last thing that a congregation needs in order to be a church in a given place. The very last thing. So let's say that a congregation has gone through all of these other things. One almost has in the back of his head the story of the rich young ruler. I've done all these things, now what do I do? And he said, give it all away. And he went away. The guy did. That was one thing we couldn't quite have. But we do have congregations that have done a beautiful job of being the church in a particular area, but they realize that in order to do it better, to do it more effectively, not build the church in order to get more members, which is almost number one on the heresy list for why you build a church, to get more members. What kind of a member is that, you know, and who needs it? Okay. I get so judgmental. But they've done it. They've done it good. Now what do? And how do they build? We just got done with a church very much like that. In Hammond, Indiana. Hammond, Indiana is the heart of one of the large steel producing areas of our country. And they had an old church that was falling down, and to simply paint it and clean it up was to throw good money after bad. And besides that, that community was, they wanted to tear the whole thing down and build garages. There was going to be no community there anymore. They didn't want to go out into the suburbs. They wanted to stay in the middle of that area. That's good. They should do that. Well, they hired an architect from Detroit. I don't know why they did that. At any rate, I'm not saying there aren't any good architects in Detroit, but why they went so far away, I don't know. At any rate, they hired an architect from Detroit who designed a Gothic A-frame church for them that cost $480,000, and I find it hard to believe in this day and age, but that building did not have one piece of steel in it. Not one. In Hammond, Indiana. The most available thing you could get, you know. Half the guys worked in the steel mill. They could stick a few pieces home in their pockets. You know? I mean, that's the way they built the early church. Let's do it again, you know. Rip off from the corporations and build a church. You know? Dedicated to Dismas, the good thief. Okay. At any rate, this guy was just not in there. He just didn't know what was cooking, and the pastor said, "We need support from a few people. We need something from the synod. We need something a little from the district, and of course, the Aid Association for Lutherans will throw in a few bucks." But really, most of it's going to come from our congregation, and we're in Hammond. And I don't know how many of you know Hammond, but Hammond might not be there 5 years from now. It really might not be. The way they're adding on to the steel mills, Or the way the steel mills are dropping junk all over the people around them, it's either get out or die, you know, and people are going. But there is an immediate need. Now, what do? The people of the congregation are Polish and Slovak and Czech and German. And you don't mess around with tradition, you know. I mean, there is a very strong tradition, and it is the tradition of a church needs to be church. It needs to look like church, okay? Well, we paid off the architect. That was just a bad deal altogether. So we paid him off, and we spent some time in various people's homes talking about what they meant by tradition. And we got a whole wide range of the most interesting things. Like the church in the home for some of these people from these Eastern European countries. The church of the city block, and that special exception, it had jolly well be beautifully made. There has to be no slapdash, no Jerry building, no Mickey Mouse. It has got to have brass. We also talked about what the mission was in the congregation to the community. What difference did they want to make as the body of Christ in that particular area? And they had already a very interesting program, relevant as could be to that territory. Drug counseling, emergency clinics for knife victims, alcoholic counseling because of the guys who work in the mills, day planning, daycare center. That's what they wanted. And what we built eventually was what Ed Silvick, whom some of you know, and who in my opinion has become probably the most significant voice in contemporary church architecture, and it's about time. He's been going through kinds of hell, but he's come up with a voice and a few people who were willing to support his approach. And the models that he has been building are, I think, where the church should go. This particular congregation opted for a thing which Ed Silvick has for a number of years been calling the centrum. The centrum does not look like a church. It looks like a civic building. It belongs to the community. There is that the church should be that it shouldn't give away. And that is the basis of the architecture. There is nothing that the church has that it shouldn't give away. Now just stop and think of where you worship. How much would you simply be willing to turn over? Just give it, you know. But by and large, the church has followed the complexion of the society in which it exists, and we are a society of collectors. We will collect anything. I don't know, if you look at an average big magazine rack, you have got a monthly publication for every single kind of little bitty thing that people collect. Bottles are a multi-million dollar business, and people have attics and basements and garages full of bottles. My mother says I was born with a silver foot in my mouth. I'm sure there are some bottle collectors here. With Matthew, it's rocks. We're going to go home with a trunk load full of rocks, and they had better all be pretty good skippers, because we're going to take them all up to Lake Michigan and see how far out they go. He's a good skipper. Okay. But we all collect, and the church collects. Czech Vatican. But you don't have to go that far. I'm just using the most extreme example. The goodies in the Vatican, you know. And generally what happens in the way of distribution to the poor is that the Pope washes the feet of a few prisoners annually. Well, you know, he could just throw all that stuff away and it would make a colossal difference and it would cut down on the tourism, you know, which probably would be a good thing. Art. We collect art. We've got to have it. You can't have a church without art. So we collect it. We collect theology. We do. We collect little different approaches to the same problem. We collect liturgy. We've got all different kinds. The church who's got the most to brag about is the church that's done one of each. You know, over a period of time, they can say they had the black people in and they had a black mass. That church is, they'll do anything. They've got it all. And they've got, you know, the Missa Luba, Missa Bossa Nova, jazz mass, folk mass. They just collect them, you know. And it's a strange kind of thing that we have in the church that makes us, for some reason, unwilling to give away the gifts that have been given to us. Over a period of time, then, this is the thing that the church had to learn. And one of the things that the church can give away is its space. And so in Hammond, they have a centrum. In Charles City, where Sobeck did this beautiful, beautiful Methodist church. It is, Charles City was wiped out by this horrible tornado and killed quite a few people. And Ed Sobeck did a centrum that is just, you gotta go there if you're anywhere in the vicinity and take the thought of that back with you. It is a building that is community oriented. They can move anything in that place out. In Hammond, you can compact the worship center so that during the week, 20 to 30 people can use it, and then all the other space is for other things, whatever the community wants. But the kind of neat thing is that what happens when the whole thing is done? I mean, like when the congregation is no longer a congregation. All of the steel people have moved into the country, or the young steel people have become execs and moved into suburbia, and there's no longer a congregation. The city of Hammond will take that building whenever it's empty and make it something. Buy it off. They'll buy it and it will be something for the community, a library, a social center, and anything, you see. I don't know whether you can call that making friends with the mammon of unrighteousness or not, but fiscally, it does not make you a slave to property, and most of us are. We become slaves to what we own, and it is bad news. It is very, very bad. So, it is within that shift, of course, that now we have architecture which is so radical that you can't even tell whether it's what it's, you know, it doesn't look right in my collection of slides of churches. It looks like storefronts in the inner city, you know, which Buckminster Fuller told us at a couple conventions ago that's what we ought to worry about. Get all those storefronts and turn those into it, you architect. Clean up those buildings and make them habitable, and put your churches up on the 13th floor where nobody else will live. You know? You know. The medical center won't have anybody, you know, practicing medicine on the 13th floor in Minneapolis. Say, you know, there are all kinds of stuff available where people are, and you put them there. But what happens is you cannot expect under those conditions for the church to look like church. It just is like church. So the slides that I've got are of the time where everything started going good in the liturgical renewal, up until the time when everything started going social. And we decided to have a kind of deep think about whether to keep pouring money into this. Now, I'm sure, and I'm going to rip through these slides with rather reckless abandon, but I am hoping there's going to be some questions. But some of you may ask, where does that put you? You know, I've got a studio that does nothing but glass. I love glass, and I put glass in churches. I mean, I put lots of glass in lots of churches. I make good money on new church building. Now, where does that put you? It puts me without a lot of good money. Seriously, that's easy. That's no problem understanding that. But it does maybe free me up to be more of the kind of person that I ought to be in this business. Glass is not a sin. Now, I think that's right. Some of mine is. Some of my glass was a sin. And I have wanted from time to time to celebrate the Feast of St. Stephen in front of one of my pieces of glass. But by and large, I can celebrate in just about any media, in anything. As soon as we depend upon one thing, even a way of making a living, we have lost our freedom.
Since I suspect from time to time that I am in hostile territory, in Copenhagen, Grundtvig, I remember doing some research on Grundtvig, working on a book with Jerry Pelikan, who considers Grundtvig an uncanonized saint. And I got to see his church, and it's remarkable, but I don't think it's Grundtvig. I don't think it looks like Grundtvig would work. But it's big, and it's Gothic. I'm showing you a lot of things which are of a tradition, but are cleaned up and have a modern facade. That's because of its uniqueness, its place, its reason for being. And of course, Copenhagen was able to do a beautiful job of the symbol in the Grundtvig Church. Here's the Church of the Holy Mackerel. This is the one that's shaped like a fish in Stamford, Connecticut. It's got all the goodies up against the east wall, you know. And what is it that you do when you worship? What do you see in here? How many pews here? We're not to the back yet. How many pews have we got? And what does the guy from here up to here see the most of on a given church service? Hair. Hair. The back of people's heads. Now, if I were called to admonish my child in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, and he turned his back on me so I saw his hair, I'd let him know which way to go next. I would turn him around and look right in his gullet. You do not deal with people in a kind, loving, and affirmative way when their backs are at one another. So what we've got here is, if they could just turn off the lights, which they can't until it gets dark outside, we've got a theater. We've got a theater. And an inflexible one. Bolted down seats. Longitudinal floor plan. Everything's so conceived. The pulpit looks like something Captain Ahab would crawl into. Saarinen, who did that beautiful thing in Minneapolis, he was this liturgical thing that we've got going in the United States, and did some very, very thoughtful things. This one is in Columbus, Indiana, but it has the same kind of feeling as the Christ Church in Minneapolis. The same kind of clarity and neatness. But he still doesn't get the picture. You know, his traditions are still hanging tough with him, and he is not in this most recent of the liturgical movement. But some of the neatness and orderliness that went on in Europe under this movement was really beautiful. And one of the first things they did was curb that back east wall so that it came around and made people feel as though they were gathering around instead of looking at. That is a neat building. Chairs instead of pews, so we got some flexibility. An altar, which is a table. I'm interested in the menorah. I like that. Probably the most important man in Europe to work on this tradition was Rudolf Schwarz, and he forms an ellipse as an ideal shape, like an egg, and puts the altar out into that wider part of the ellipse and continues a bunch of detail around, particularly lighting, to give the impression that there is an action that moves, particularly the outside aisle. This is a very important church in the liturgical renewal. It's amazing, some of the things, some of the cleanliness, the sense of orderliness, but they're still, in spite of it all, in spite of the contemporaneity of the look of this thing, is a fear to remove that wall, that barrier that breaks the, that causes the separation of the laity from the actions in the chancel. All the light is up there. I worry about that. And I have a lot of trouble with light coming at me when I worship. Things tend to want to get thrown into silhouette. All the Gothic tradition had light above, up in the loft, so that you had a lot of dark space behind the altar and things were visible. Tends to flatten out a lot.
What church is that?
That's in St. Louis. Kretzmann's Church in St. Louis. Transfiguration. Another design that shows this kind of circular motif. There used to be some really harebrained ideas with that altar in the middle, and the priest almost had to become a whirling dervish in order to reach the eyes of his congregation. So they wound up, as Schwarz indicated, with an ellipse or with a cut circle so that the word could still be given without anyone turning his back. But the feeling of people gradually beginning to become aware of one another, incredibly important in the design of the church. The inside of that beautiful little barn by Bill Bronson, that once again shows it. Look at the lighting, just a small detail like that, where that ellipse goes up and comes back out again, to give a sense of participation in what's going up on up there. And the altar brought out from that back wall and made available, accessible to the congregation. More of this kind of thing, except the pews destroy the flexibility. Another ellipse. You can see how it is done in the roof. It's the St. John Capistrano Church outside of Munich. The inside of Rochon, the little, just a few pews, everything else is open. Just a few pews down one side in an asymmetrical manner. Everything else is wide open with a slant. The last time Liz and I were there, there were goats in there, and a cow was nibbling the grass on the outside. It was kind of neat. That's it. That's it. Except for the bolted down pews, that is where the action is and how it's defined. You know, where do you work at the church according to the liturgy? There's only one problem here, and it makes you wonder why it's, and really they bothered with that arrangement. If they're going to pile all that stuff on the altar, it's like the poor priest has to look out through the bushes in order to get at his people.
Why the railing, right?
That's a good question. The railing is because people must kneel in that church. And I'm glad that the railing is no more than a crutch to help people get up and down. Some railings are so elaborate that they become a division between congregation and altar. But these people insist on kneeling. Well, shoot, we do too. But we help each other up and down, you know, which seems to make more sense to me. And an awful lot of churches now don't kneel at all, following the tradition of Passover, when you stood with your loins girded about, eating the meal and ready with your staff in hand to move out. You know, and I like that. I really do. This is a church in Wichita Falls in Texas. A part of the congregation, sometimes the choir and sometimes not, stands on the other side, or sits on the other side, and the rest of the congregation sits on this side with the altar elevated in the center. Taze it. And if you've never been there, go. French is not my language, but I understood every word. They were warm and beautiful, and it was one of the most exciting experiences. And you can see what a worship thing is for them. I used to be in the old meeting house churches that all backed at the front door, and you walked in and you picked your chair up and sat it down where you wanted it. And when it was done, you put it back and left that room open, you see. And that's kind of the tradition of Taze. None of this pew business. Everybody gets all, why, you know, if all these chairs are scattered all around, it's going to, you know, the arrangement is going to be not nice. Ridiculous. Absolute. What is sacred about arranging chairs? I don't understand.
Tell me about that chandelier.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's wired with a ring around it.